Native plants and grasses are a great addition to any lawn or garden. And on this edition of Garden Talk, we will find out what we should do for seeding, transplanting, and dividing native plants this fall. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller, and this is Garden Talk. If you have questions about native plants or an experience you'd like to share with our guest expert, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Our guest is Neil DeBall from Prairie Nursery. He knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses, and he has great advice to share whether you have a few square feet or acres of prairie. Neil, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
It's good to have you on this day after Thanksgiving. Was it a good year for native plants? Are you thankful for the native plants this year?
I am. It was a good year. It was a reasonable weather. We had a good business year, and hopefully 2016 will be a great year, too, for gardeners all around.
Well, we'll talk more about how our native plants did this year and maybe how we can plan for the spring a native garden, which is something I'm very interested in doing. But let's talk a little bit about what we might be able to do this fall. Can you talk about fall prairie management options?
Yeah, we're kind of moving towards the end of that, obviously, because it's getting pretty wintry out there. But some people like to burn their prairies in the fall, and burning is a management tool that has many different results depending upon the timing of how it is used. And some people like to burn in the fall, some people like to burn in the spring. Which of those options you choose does depend upon what your management goals are. If you burn your prairie in fall, it's usually fairly neutral as far as its impact on the prairie flowers versus the prairie grasses. It doesn't seem to favor one group over the other very much. Some research indicates that maybe the flowers are benefited a little bit. However, when we're trying to control non-native cool season weeds and cool season grasses, which can be very competitive in a prairie situation, and most of your prairie plants, not all, but most, are what we call warm season plants. They grow under warm soil conditions. Cool season plants do best under cool conditions in early spring and mid-spring and then in fall with a summer kind of lull. So we have problems with quackgrass, bluegrass, clovers. There's a lot of cool season plants that weren't here originally when the prairies were developed over the thousands of years. And so they can become invasive in the prairie. And what we do is we wait until they get up 4 or 5, 6 inches tall in the spring. And that is when we burn the prairie, which then sets those plants back because it burns them to the ground. And they've used the nutrients and the energy from their roots to develop that new growth, but they've had a limited amount of time for photosynthesis in the spring to replenish those reserves in their roots. So it's kind of like they've made a withdrawal from their bank account and got nothing back for a return on investment. Also, after you burn, the soil turns black. And in the spring, if you have warm, sunny days, the soil warms up very rapidly, and then that favors the predominantly warm season prairie plants over the cool season undesirable plants.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, I don't want to burn this fall anymore. I want to burn in the spring.
It depends on what your goals are.
Yeah.
Okay, if you don't have a lot of problems with cool season weeds, then burning in the fall is perfectly reasonable. Now, if you want to create or retain habitat for wildlife over the winter, then you would not want to burn or mow down your prairie in the fall. Some people like everything neatened up in the fall, and so they mow everything down or burn everything in the fall so it looks nice and quote-unquote neat. If your goal is to support birds and other wildlife, then you probably want to leave your prairie up over the fall. That's what I do at my house. I never do a fall burn because my goal is to, number one, enjoy the beautiful prairie grasses over the winter, and to maintain as much habitat and cover for wildlife over the winter to assist them. And many of your insects, pollinators, butterflies, etc., have some overwintering strategies. Not all, but many have overwintering strategies as larvae or pupa, sometimes adults, eggs, etc., that are associated with those plants. So if you mow everything down or burn everything, then that's gone, and that can impact the populations in the following spring.
We have an emailer, Treva, who emails, "This is the first year I was supposed to burn my 1,000-square-foot prairie. I used charcoal lighter fluid to saturate balled-up newspaper all around the prairie, plus a box full of shredded paper in the middle of it. It has a lot of tall weeds, so I was hoping to get rid of them all, as well as the necessary burning of the prairie. I set all of that on fire, but I couldn't get it to burn for long. The leaves burned off the dry stalks, and it all stopped there, except for some leaves that burned on the ground. It was very uninspiring.
Nothing worse than an uninspiring prairie burn, I'll tell you.
So then Treva asks, so what do I do now? Mow it in the spring? I was really hoping I could burn it.
Yeah. And, you know, the secret to burning a prairie is you have to have sufficient, what we call in fire science, fine fuels. Okay. And those are in prairies usually grasses. And sometimes we generally say third year after seeding is the year when you want to first start burning to control cool season weeds, et cetera. Trees and shrubs also, so they don't begin to invade by burning those back. You can prevent them or at least greatly reduce their invasion. So if you don't have good grass growth, then you're not going to have sufficient fine fuels to carry that burn. And I'm guessing that's what Treva has, is she doesn't have, the grasses have not yet matured and developed to the point where there's enough density of the grasses to carry a fire. Another factor in fire is temperature, relative humidity, and soil moisture, and wind speed. Okay, these are the four biggest factors. So if it's a cold day, humidity is high, and your soil is moist, it's going to be really hard to burn. Now, on a nice day in mid to late April, if it's 80-something degrees and you don't have a lot of moisture in the soil and the humidity is low, then you can get a fire to burn where if you'd had a cooler day or a moisture day, it would never burn at all. So selecting the time of the burn is important. But many areas of the state, you can't burn until after 6 p.m. So you have to know your local regulations as far as when you can burn. But you got to have grass in a prairie to make it burn. So what to do? The best thing to do is wait until next spring. And at the same time that you might have planned to burn, which in southern Wisconsin is usually between April 15th and or the first week in May, if your goal is to control cool season weeds and trees, etc., instead of burning, you take a mower and mow it right down to the dirt as close as you can, and then you rake off the mowings to expose the soil, and this will mimic the effects of burning within about 50 to 70% effectiveness as burning.
Yeah. Would you want to burn it, or not burn it, but mow it right now in the fall? If you, what about mowing it now?
You could, and like for people who like to neaten things up, that's fine. But then you lose the cover for wildlife and all those seeds that are suspended on the plants on their seed heads. Those then become less accessible or less visible for wildlife. So your bird use utilization will probably be reduced.
Yeah, I would. I would like to see the grasses and such as well.
You know, in the winter, all those cool seed heads and everything, it adds another element to the landscape that otherwise you wouldn't have. It was just a mowed lawn-like look. So for me, I never burn in the fall or mow everything down. I just let it stand for the wildlife and enjoy it.
I'm Joy Cardine in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk, talking about native plants today with Neil DeBall, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. If you have a question about native plants, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And if you have a photograph that you'd like to post, you can do that as well, and maybe we can talk about it. Let's go to the phones and take Leo in Dodgeville. Hello, Leo.
Good morning. My question is, it's probably way too complex, so I'm going to really pare it down now as I've been thinking about it here. But I've got 3 or 4 acres that had been mowed previous to us. We've been here for about 8 years now, and I'm not wanting to mow as much. I've got a lot of oaks. So I'm trying to bring back kind of an oak savanna sort of environment. And so I've been kind of cutting out low maples that are around and things like that. And I've just got my oaks coming up. But I also have lots of berries and things. And I haven't burned any of that. I've burned a couple of little small patches, you know, I don't know, 200 or 300 square foot patches here and there. And I'm just trying to I'm trying to figure out what I should do about the berries. That would be my question, is what I can do about a lot of berries that are coming up. And I'd like to get those not as prominent.
Okay, stay on the line, Leo, because I got a couple questions for you to help clarify a couple things.
Okay.
Okay. I assume if you say berries, are these raspberries, like prickle bushes, or what kind of berries are they?
Oh, I guess they're just black caps is what they are, of course.
Black caps, okay. Black raspberries, okay. Yeah, that's commonly found in oak savannas that are mowed, and then you quit mowing, and then all kinds of stuff comes up, and those are quite common. And they're a native plant, which also is a good wildlife plant, but they're not particularly user-friendly. So a lot of people don't like having big thickets of raspberries and blackberries in their woods. So it comes back to really what your goals are for this area. Do you want to do an ecological restoration? Do you want to have a lower maintenance, more open look, a savanna look, without putting a lot of time and investment into changing the vegetative structure? It really depends on what your goals are as far as how you want to proceed with this. Do you have anything else growing there of any interest? Any native flowers that survived the mowing, or is it pretty much just grass and raspberries and blackberries?
Well, I've got a fair amount of spring ephemerals coming up all over the place, and that was the first thing that I really wanted to try to get going. And I mowed all the berries down at one point. There's just one section, really, of that.
Sure.
But, like, they're on the move. I mean, like, they're going to...
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to... That's what I'm wondering about, what I can do about that.
Okay.
And still like the spring ephemerals.
Okay, yeah, and they creep by rhizomes. Okay, here's a couple strategies you can use to control the raspberries, blackberries. One is a mowing strategy. And you wait until your spring ephemerals have bloomed and set seed. Most, depending on the species, most of them will have done this by early to mid-July. You can then go in and mow everything down to the ground. The raspberries will resprout, go back in about a month later, and mow them again, assuming you don't have any other desirable vegetation that would be damaged by the mowing. And if they continue to come back, you can mow them about a month later. If you continually mow them on this schedule, you will gradually deplete their root systems. I won't say you'll get rid of them completely, but you'll greatly reduce them. Another choice is assuming that you do not have any desirable broadleaf wildflowers or tree or shrubs, saplings coming up in there. You can, if you so desire, use a broadleaf herbicide in the summer after all your spring ephemerals have gone dormant, so there are no actively growing green leaves remaining on your desirable flowers. Wait till they're completely dormant and disappeared and dried up. Then you can go in August and spray the raspberries, blackberries with a broadleaf selective herbicide made for killing brush. But be very, very careful. These tend to be very powerful herbicides. You want to take all the necessary precautions. I use only one broadleaf herbicide on my property. It's called Milestone. The active ingredient is aminopyrrolid. It is good on most species. And it is the only broadleaf herbicide that has received the EPA's reduced risk designation because of its low toxicity to mammals, pets, birds, etc. So that's a good choice for you. It's not cheap, but it's the safest broadleaf herbicide that is known at this time or been approved.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Good
thanks.
Luck.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Leo. I'm Joy Cardine in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk. Our guest is Neil DeBall, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, talking about native plants and grasses today. We'll also talk about low-maintenance lawns and dividing native plants and much more. If you have a question, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. We are managing our prairie gardens this hour during Garden Talk. I'm Joy Cardine in for Larry Mueller, talking with the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Neil DeBall. And with you, if you would like to call in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Barb in Racine. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I was wondering about the safety of burning, what you would do so you contain it and you don't burn down the town or
your
neighbor's yard.
Okay. Well, you know, burning is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used for good or ill. And it's very important that you understand the dynamics of fire science and burning and that you use it with great respect. I've been burning since I was a kid. Some sanctioned, some not. I was fortunate enough to be able to turn it in a positive direction in my daily work. But the most important aspect of burning is, number one, to understand how fire behaves. And going back to what we talked about previously, temperature, relative humidity, soil moisture, and wind speed. These are very, very important factors that will determine the rate of combustion and the danger associated. And there are some days when you simply absolutely should not burn. And if you're ever in question, a very simple way is to do your burning in the evening. Usually at that time, temperatures are lower, relative humidities are higher, and assuming you don't have abnormal meteorological conditions, you should have generally lower wind speeds. So High temperatures, low relative humidities, and high winds are what lead to out-of-control fires. Also, it's very important that you build fire breaks into your landscape. So if you have a prairie, you want to make sure it has impervious fire breaks all around it, whether that's a road, a driveway, a mowed lawn, a pond, a river, a big river, not a river that fire can jump across. So you want to make sure you build into that design the fire break. So you don't, not at the last minute, scrambling to put in fire breaks around your prairie. And for more detailed information, we have a lot of information posted on our website. And I have an article called Burning Your Prairie Safely. And you can go to our website at www.prairienursery.com. And there's a section called Guides and tools, guides and information. It's listed in a group. And in there, there's a whole bunch of different articles. And look for the article, Burning Your Prairie Safely. And you'll find that article gives you step-by-step information on how to do this without burning down the town.
Thank you, Barb, for that question. You know, it's interesting. I think it was last spring, this very last spring, when my husband and I thought we would go to Horicon Marsh and do a little early bird watching, and it was on fire, but on purpose. It was a controlled burn.
That's
and
a
it
big
was
burn.
Boy, was that it was really, talk about inspiring. It was actually it was magnificent. It was huge.
It's really amazing. Yeah.
And the point though was that this was going to make the habitat much better for the birds.
Yes. Burning grassland systems and in many cases wetland ecosystems is very rejuvenating. And your goal with these systems is to maintain herbaceous vegetation and prevent invasion by trees and shrubs, among other things. It also is very rejuvenating for much of the vegetation by recycling nutrients that are released after the burning process, as well as warming up the soil earlier in the spring, increasing total plant productivity. So, yeah, fire is a wonderful, wonderful tool. It's been used by people for thousands and thousands of years. The Native Americans burned the prairies in North America. The people of Africa have burned the savannas of Central Africa for thousands of years. And the European steppes of Ukraine and Russia were also burned, apparently, by indigenous peoples prior to agriculture and development.
Well, you know, we have had a very seemingly long and mild fall, though we have had some snow that has, most of it, it seems, has been, at least in the Madison area, was washed away by the recent rains and in warmer temperatures. But I think there's still some snow here and there. Is it too late to do anything fall maintenance-wise?
Well, you can, if your goal is to mow down an existing prairie, you can certainly still do that. You have to be careful. We had all this rain. Now, we had about an inch of rain in Madison over yesterday, a little bit more in some places. So you have to be really careful if you're using equipment that you don't rut it up and get stuck and make a mess of things, so that can harm the plants, obviously. But you could still, certainly if things dry out, you could still go out and cut things down. Burning at this point is going to be extremely difficult because the temperatures and humidities are not going to be in your favor. You're going to get probably very incomplete and poor burns. Most people will burn their prairies in the fall, usually in October. So we're pushing December here. So not exactly the best timing for that. I would wait until spring to do this sort of maintenance. And it's really a little bit late for gardeners who want to divide plants. It's really late. There are ways you can sneak this in if you want to. But
if you really know what you're doing.
You got to really know what you're doing. You want to make sure it's above freezing because you don't expose the plants to too cold a temperature. And not to mention yourself. Okay, but some plants can be divided really late into the season. Most of your grasses are really hard to kill. Ferns are not so hard. And many of your spring ephemeral wildflowers, like shooting stars, trilliums, bloodroot, Virginia bluebells, these can be divided very late. But if you're doing these late divisions in November, even into early December, after you divide the plants and put them into the soil, the most important thing is to mark each plant with a little flag, and then put 6 inches of clean, weed-free straw mulch over the entire area to create a blanket to insulate the plants so they are not exposed to cold weather. It's amazing. You can actually get by with very late dividing if you follow this procedure, then because that protects the plants over winter. And it's not so much the ultimate temperatures that hurt plants. It's the rate of change. And by putting that blanket over there, you reduce the rate of change. And then in the spring, you just scrape away the mulch right around the root crown, a couple inches, and then they come up through the straw, and the straw holds moisture in place. You leave the straw in place in the spring, holds moisture in place, and then also prevents weed germination.
Great. Good to know. But let's say I don't want to chance it, and I don't want to divide outside yet this fall because I'm not very good at it. When would I be able to do that then next year?
The best time is in early spring before the plants actually start to grow or as you just start to see them sprouting out of the ground. Exceptions to this include some of your spring ephemerals, which can be very, very sensitive if they are divided after they begin growth in the spring, and those are best divided in late summer or fall, assuming they're dormant at that time. So your early blooming flowers, divide them in September, October, and a lot of your other plants that are more summer and fall bloomers, usually you can very effectively divide those in the spring, early spring.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question about your prairie garden or your native plants and grasses. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine in for Larry Mueller, and our Garden Talk guest is Neil DeBall, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. Our next caller is Al in Abrams. Hello, Al.
Hello, Neil.
Mr. Strands, how are you?
Great. We know each other, huh? Okay.
Yeah, we go way back.
We've been burning stuff for 40 years.
Yes, sir.
Neil, have you ever tried to control common or glossy buckthorn?
I have extensive experience with common buckthorn, not so much with glossy. I think the principles are pretty much the same.
But what do you do?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any other desirable vegetation associated with the buckthorn?
No, this is underneath an old Christmas tree plantation that we clear cut, and now it's waist-high buckthorn, and we'd like to get rid of that and establish some, and this is in northern Forest County, so it established a northern prairie, maybe even savannah-type situation.
Okay. Sandy soil, Al?
It's real mixed. We've got higher spots with sandy gravel and silt on the slopes in the lower areas.
Okay.
So we're going to spot, you know, kind of make a mosaic in there.
Okay. And how many acres are you working with, Al?
We could do up to 40 if we live long enough.
Wow.
Okay. So we're talking large scale. We're not going.
Yes.
We're not going to do cut stump treatment. Okay.
Yeah. If we tried stump treatment. It worked great, but we just ran out of manpower.
Yeah, that's on that kind of acreage. I have a 15-acre buckthorn farm. Well, 20 acres, but 15 of it was buckthorn. And it's almost all gone after 25 years. That's all. Almost all of that is cut and stump treatment.
So that means you cut it and you put the brush off on it or something.
And you do this in the fall, September, October, November, into the winter. I go out there as long as the herbicide isn't freezing in the container, I'll go out there.
So if you have a couple of them, you can do that treatment. But for Al's 40 acres, you need something more.
Yeah, and in that case, Al, you're going to have to use herbicides. And I'll tell you, in the old days, and here's the interesting thing about buckthorn. If you use glyphosate, a.k.a. Roundup, and spray it as a foliar herbicide in late summer, early fall, which is the recommended time usually for killing brush with a foliar herbicide, if you use straight Roundup, it will not kill the plant. The leaves will fall off, but it will resprout. And you can use Roundup as a cut stump, concentrated, 20 to 40% concentrated glyphosate. As a cut stump in the fall, you'll get 99.99% kill. Also, you can use Garlon. Okay, which is a broadleaf herbicide, you can use that as a cut stump treatment and get excellent kill. But if you use a foliar application of Garlon only, it will not kill the buckthorn. The leaves will fall off and they will resprout. You can, however, mix glyphosate and Garlon together in the same tank mix and spray the buckthorn in late summer, early fall, and you'll get almost 100% kill with that combination, interestingly. Another choice is to use Milestone aminopyrrolid in a very low concentration, as recommended on the label. I think I use about a half an ounce per gallon, and use that as a foliar spray in late September, October on buckthorn, and I get phenomenal kill. So,
and that's Milestone, you said?
Yeah, Milestone. Milestone's kind of expensive, Al, but Garlon's not exactly cheap. So you'd have to look at it. And you have to use more Garlon than you do Milestone in your tank. So by the time you pay more for the Milestone because you're using less, it might actually be cheaper to use the aminopyrrolid.
Sure.
Okay, and so that should give you a really good kill. And now the next thing is, have those buckthorn plants reached the stage where they've produced fruit? And so is there a seed bank in the ground?
There's just starting to be some mature enough to have seeds.
Okay.
And those I've been trying to attack those first.
Okay. If you have any seed bank in there, you're going to have a big flush of seedlings at least in the first year after you kill. Because if you kill them in September, October, the next spring, you're undoubtedly going to have a significant flush of buckthorn seedlings, depending on how many plants actually went to seed. Buckthorn seeds, fortunately, do not have a very long lifespan in the soil, just a couple of years. So, but I would not plant anything the next year. Unless you're planting grasses. Now, here's the other choice. You can just plant prairie grass if this is your goal. Obviously, if you want a more diverse prairie, especially for pollinators, grasses won't accomplish much. But a lot of people will plant grasses in the first season, and then they use a broadleaf herbicide later that summer after the grasses have gotten 3 to 4 inches tall, and then they use that to kill any buckthorn seedlings that appear.
Okay.
So that's another option. And then that fall, assuming you've got the buckthorn seedlings under control, the fall, after you plant the prairie grass in the spring, get the buckthorn under control with the broadleaves, and then that fall you can go in and overseed with the forbs.
Okay, doc.
The trick with overseeding with forbs is you have to do that in the first or second season. By the third season, the grasses are so dense there's very little place for the forbs to become established, and you're going to be throwing your money away. So if you're going to overseed with forbs, do it in the first or the second year after seeding your grass.
Boy, that sounds like a lot of work, but good luck, Al.
All right. Good luck, Mr. Trance.
Yep, take care, Neil.
All right, too. Yeah. Why can't he just torch that thing?
Well, you first of all, he probably doesn't have any fuel because there's probably very little grass because it was a pine plantation.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there's probably very little fuel unless they left all the slash in place. But that's hard to say. But what happens with almost all non-coniferous trees, deciduous trees and shrubs, is you burn them to the ground, they just resprout.
Right, yeah.
And it actually makes your life more miserable because now instead of one stem, and when they resprout, you got 10 stems, and it's much harder to deal with that, depending upon what your methodology is.
Now, the buckthorn is just, that's a thorn in my side. It's all over my yard, no matter what I do. It's all over the place.
I wish deer would eat buckthorn.
Yeah, why don't
they? Why don't the deer eat the buckthorn?
Yeah, no, and those are spread mainly by birds doing stuff? Yeah, okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. If you look at the name, it's called Rhamnus catharticus. It's very cathartic because it is basically an emetic, meaning that it makes the birds poop after they eat it.
Yeah, so they eat it, and then that's how they seed everybody's yard.
They fly all around, sit in your tree, and boom, buckthorn.
Yeah. There we go. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have any questions about native plants, if you have a prairie and would like some help taking care of it, or maybe you want to get started like I would like to. We have Angie in Glendale with our next question. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I am so excited to be able to say hello to Neil, and I want to highly recommend that people look at his catalog of various native plants that he sells, actually. But the point I want to make is the catalog is laid out so that it's really a learning tool for people who are nervous about starting native plants or ask, what should I do first? It is such a helpful, it's almost like a Bible a go-to for just so many things.
Are you a beginner, Angie, or are you a pro?
Yeah, we were beginners, and we went up to Neil's place there, and it was so helpful. I mean, the people there themselves are very helpful, but we got the catalog and have been using it ever since.
Wow. And I have a catalog in front of me, so I'm looking forward to looking at this. But this is for me to order stuff in the spring, or what's the deal with this, Neil?
Yeah, we offer plants and seeds. I also do landscape consultations and designs in the state of Wisconsin. And we have a mail order catalog, and I can give the phone number if people want. Now, nobody's at the office today, but there's a line to just say if you'd like a catalog, and we'll pick that up. But you can just call us at 1-800-476-9453, and when it prompts you if you'd like to request a catalog, and you just hit like whatever number it is, and then I'll leave your name and address.
And I know that the prairienursery.com website is also linked to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Yep. So.
And if you want, you can just go to our website, and there's a place to request a catalog there. And, you know, I really appreciate your comment, Angie, because, you know, when I started doing this 33 years ago, every single plant that we sell was a weed. The locals in West, well, a couple guys.
You mean a weed to somebody is a wonderful plant to somebody
else.
Exactly,
yeah. Exactly. But see, these were native plants, and they weren't accepted into the fold of the garden. And so A local farmer friend of mine called this the weed farm. In fact, many people call this the weed farm.
Well, you know, to tell us some, I mean, people, maybe somebody is listening right now who's thinking, well, what exactly is a native plant? Can you kind of just rattle off of some of the common ones that maybe we are familiar
with?
Well,
let's define native plant. Native plants are defined as those plants that grew in any given location, in this case, Wisconsin, prior to European settlement. So usually 1840 is kind of like the cutoff year. And then, you know, as settlers came, they started bringing plants from the old country, okay, from grandma's garden in the old country, and planting, you know, lilacs and, you know, different, yeah, all sorts of
those lilacs are not native.
No, lilacs are not native. I love lilacs. Yeah. I've got lilacs at my house. I'm not one of these native plant Nazis where I only have native plants in my yard. I mean, people come and they see hostas at my house. They go, oh my God, Neil, you traitor, you're growing
up. Because hostas are not native either.
No, goodness, no. They're from Japan, Korea, and China. So, but they're perfectly wonderful in a shade garden. And I mix them with my native wildflowers. And
ferns are native.
Most some ferns are native and non-native ferns.
Yeah.
Of course, you have, you know, it's just which plants of what species were originally here prior to European settlement. So
trilliums are native.
Most of your trilliums, yes. In fact, pretty much all the trilliums that are sold here, are native.
And what are some others that, you know, that maybe are...
Oh, goodness. There's thousands of native plants. In Wisconsin, we have, oh, gosh, I think 1,800 and something native plants. And, you know, only the ones that, realistically, people can derive joy from horticulturally, or the fact that they feed wildlife, or that they have some other unique function in the ecosystem. Most people don't grow all the native plants. I mean, I could grow you. I could make you a beautiful native garden of poison ivy and ragweed.
I'll pass on that.
And raspberries. And,
oh, I'll take the raspberries though.
and prickly ash. Okay, so there's some pretty non-user friendly native plants. But we got a wide variety of coneflowers that grow on the prairie and oaks. Oaks, which are the number one tree for supporting insects.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I would strongly recommend anybody that wants to learn more about native, especially native woody plants, read a book called "Bringing Nature Home" by Doug Tallamy. He's an entomologist at the University of Delaware, and he did groundbreaking research on documenting the use of native and non-native plants by native insects. And he found that native plants attract like 10 times more native insects pollinators.
And I was going to say, why do I want to attract more native insects?
Well, for one reason, they're an incredible important part of the whole food web. And if you look at, let's just look at parasitic wasps, okay? Parasitic wasps are part of a subfamily, or I guess it's a family, actually, insect family, called the Hymenoptera, which includes ants, bees, and wasps. And E.O. Wilson, the great entomologist at Harvard, calls the Hymenoptera the little things that keep the world running right, because there's a parasitic wasp for almost every single
boy, that's
insect, spider, tick. There's something there's always a parasitic wasp that keeps everything in control. And so we never see them because of these little bitty things. They're not the wasps that sting you. These are wasps that are going after other insects, et cetera. And they keep everything in control. And so by having a really diverse garden with lots of native plants, you then support the diversity of nature. And then you have nature doing the work for you. So you don't have to go out there and spray chemicals and all this kind of stuff, which just kills the good guys anyway. So you create the conditions to support the diversity of life that is so wonderful and enriches our lives. And they do most of the work for you.
You know, Jackson emails, I have established butterfly milkweed. Oh, great. Now I just lost it because, here we go. I have established butterfly milkweed and bee balm in my garden. I will be moving in the spring. Is it possible to transplant these new plants to a new location?
Okay, that's butterfly weed and bee balm, is that correct?
Butterfly milkweed and bee balm.
Okay, butterfly milkweed is a taproot. It's very difficult to move mature butterfly milkweeds because you disrupt the root. So that will probably be an exercise in futility and disappointment. The bee balm is a no-brainer. That is a shallow-rooted rhizomatous species. You can dig that up. You can dig that up any time of year and cut it back as long as you keep the soil around it so you don't disrupt the root system. If you move it in the summer, just cut it back and it'll re-sprout. Other choice is just to move it in the spring. Or if you're not going to move till later, you can move it in the spring, put it into a pot, and hold it in the pot until you actually move later, and then plant it when you move.
A caller who dropped off did want to know if milkweed was one of the plants that you supply at Prairie Nursery.
We supply 5 different species of milkweed plants. Okay, the butterfly milkweed, common milkweed, Solomon's milkweed, red milkweed, and whorled milkweed.
And which one do I want for the monarchs?
Well, it depends. When you look at monarchs, you're looking at, most importantly, the plants that are going to support the larva, because the monarch butterflies are very specific to members of the milkweed family. So the best one of all, one of the favorite, is the red milkweed, or sometimes called swamp milkweed or marsh milkweed, Asclepias incarnata. This is one of the top plants for supporting the larva stage of the caterpillars of the monarch. And it grows in heavy clay soil. It grows in any good garden soil. So that would be the first choice. But you have also the fact that many of the monarchs also use the all the other species for their larvae, as well as the flowers for nectar.
I might have to try that. Somebody gave me some seeds, and I planted them, and I was unsuccessful with just going from seeds. I think I need to get the plant itself.
For a lot of people, it's really best to start off with plants.
Yeah.
And then you can experiment with the seeds, and once you get some experience, you'll find that with a little experience, you can be quite successful with the seeds as well.
Let's go to Lee in Green Bay now. Hi, Lee. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi to both of you. Neil, I've got a product I picked up at a big box store. It's called Kiltol. There's 41%, it says on the label, glyphosate in this product. I've got cottonwood saplings that are getting out of control. I have just about 20 acres where I live. But isn't it kind of late in the year? I know I heard you mention earlier where I could spray the stumps, you know, whack them off and spray the stumps. Because it's not taking anything down now. They're not active, right?
Oh, excellent. Not at all. They're actually, I kill woody plants from September through the end of March, usually, depending on the weather. When the plants are either sending the energy down into their roots, September, October, as they complete the season, that's a great time to kill woody plants. And you don't want to spray the stumps, and you don't want to dilute it. You're at 21%, that's like the minimum if you're going to use glyphosate for killing.
This is 41%.
Oh, it's 41. Okay.
4-1.
Okay, yeah, that's the standard, 41.6, whatever. Yeah, you can use that undiluted. Some people will cut it down to 20%. I wouldn't go below 20%, so you can mix it 50-50 with water. I just put it on straight, and what I do is I don't spray it, because then I'm using more herbicide and I'm spraying it. What I do is I put the whatever herbicide I'm using, usually glyphosate, because it's cheap and it works on almost all your woody plants when you do a fall and winter cut stump treatment. So I put it in a dishwashing detergent bottle. Liquid dishwashing detergent, mm-hmm. one with the top that goes up and down, not the cap that pops open, but the one that goes up and down, and I can control it so it just goes to a drip. And so I just drip right where I want it. So there's no spray, there's no wastage, there's no extra application on your property. Also, remember, when you're doing woody plant control, the only part of the stump that you need to treat is the first half inch inside the bark. That's called the cambium, and that's where the xylem and phloem, the transport cells of water and food, exist. Everything inside of that is dead. So all you have to do is treat the half inch inside the bark and leave the rest untreated. Don't waste your herbicide.
But you're saying that even right now in Green Bay, he can do this?
I do this all winter. I mean, you don't want to go out there when your herbicide is turning to slush in your container. But usually you're probably not going to want to be out there then either.
Yeah.
But you can do this even into late winter, mm-hmm. as long as the sap is not flowing up. Once the sap starts to flow up, then the herbicide will not be translocated down into the roots, and you will not get kill. How do you tell if the sap is flowing up? Very simple. If you're going to go out in a day in late March, early April, and we've had a couple of very cool springs, I've been able to actually go out and treat buckthorn and other woody plants until mid-April the last couple of springs because they were so late. That's very unusual. Mm-hmm. But you cut your first stump, wait 60 seconds, and if you see moisture welling up on the top of that stump after you cut it, then it's too late, because now the sap is moving up. If it stays dry after you cut it, 60 seconds, you're good to go. And you can go all the way, depending on the year, sometimes all the way into April, and it will translocate down to those roots during the dormant period, and you will get wonderful, wonderful kill. But make sure you use at least 20% glyphosate when you're doing this.
All right, good luck, Lee. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk. We are talking about native plants and grasses and getting information about our native gardens. Welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Neil DeBall, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine in for Larry Mueller, talking with Neil DeBall, president of Prairie Nursery, talking about native plants and grasses, and welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post your question on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And back to the phones, David in Roberts is with us. Hi, David.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a question for Neil. Some time ago, he discussed using wild ginger as the control for buckthorn in the woods, and I'm wondering how much success he's had with that. I've been fighting it for quite a few years.
How do you use wild ginger to control buckthorn?
It's amazing. I noticed 25 years ago, if you walk in a native woods, wild ginger, where wild ginger grows, mm-hmm. it often will form monocultural stands, almost to the exclusion of any other species.
Oh.
So you have these beds, and they're really quite attractive, of this low-growing plant, wild ginger, which never grows more than 6 inches tall, and it's rhizomatous, so it creeps and crawls. So I thought, my gosh, what's going on with this? And I have this, and typically you will find its preferred habitat. It grows in many well-drained soils. It won't take any moisture, but it often grows on the really, really rocky limestone and dolomite slopes that are not uncommon in southern Wisconsin. And at my house, I have a hillside that's all dolomite and rocky and dry and shaded by oaks after I cut down all the buckthorn. But this whole area was completely infested with buckthorn. And the problem is, after you cut down the buckthorn, you still have trees over them, okay, if you have a woods, and the birds still sit in the trees, and they still poop out the buckthorn seeds. And it's just like Sisyphus rolling the rock up the hill, and I got rid of all the buckthorn. And, oh, look, now I have seedlings everywhere. Geez, what do I do? So I said, gee, I wonder if I plant wild ginger, if it will keep out the buckthorn like it appears to do in nature. So that's exactly what I did. And this rock, I mean, it's like 20% soil, 80% rock, and I'm using a pickaxe to plant my wild ginger. And after about 3 years, I plant them about 1 foot on center. And after 3 years, they grow together and they form this solid mat. And it keeps out buckthorn.
Neat.
It keeps out garlic mustard.
Oh.
It keeps out Tartarian honeysuckle. I had a little incursion by Canada thistle, surprisingly, in the shade, even semi-shade. I was surprised. But I think since I installed that bed 15 years ago, I've pulled out three or four. And this is a big bed. I mean, it's 30 feet wide by 100 and something feet long. And I've pulled out less than a dozen buckthorn seedlings over
so
that time.
That is amazing. I had no idea.
It's totally amazing. I believe the plant is a allelopathic, meaning that it uses chemical warfare. And the roots exude some kind of substance into the soil that is toxic to other plants and prevents them from germinating and growing. And this is well documented in the plant world. There are plants that do this.
Oh.
And wild ginger, it smells and tastes just like ginger.
I was going to say, you can use that for ginger tea or whatever you want.
Yeah, absolutely. You can make tea out of it. You can make candy ginger. You go on the internet, there's recipes for this.
But I can only plant this on limestone rock. I don't want to plant this where, I don't know, my arborvitae or something.
It seems to be a calcophile, where it likes soils that are high in calcium. So when I plant it in dry sand, it struggles. Okay, it's very drought tolerant, but it just seems to have certain nutritional requirements. It seems to really do well. If you have really dry sand, you could lime the heck out of it to help it grow. So it mm-hmm. does have to have really well-drained soils. Usually it's found in higher pH soils where the pH is at least 6.5, and it will grow in soils with very high pH over 7.5, no problem. Right? It will grow right on, almost on the rock. It's a great plant.
Sounds like I'm on the right track.
You are on the right track, but make sure you get rid of all the buckthorn first.
Yeah. Thank you, David, for that question.
Good luck.
We have a lot of people are calling in with or emailing in questions about getting rid of stuff.
Yes.
And here's Jeff emails, how do you get rid of black locust? And I wondered if that was the same answer for every question, and it's not the same answer for every question.
No, every species has its own strategy. And
how do you get rid of black locust?
Black locust is a clonal tree. Black locust is a native tree that occurs naturally in the central Midwest out to the east. It was brought into Wisconsin from the south, often a lot of it in the drought of the 30s, because it grows on very dry sandy soils and it stabilizes the soil. So you had these sand dunes, especially in central Wisconsin where our nursery is. I mean, there were dust storms in the 30s. And so a lot of people planted pines, but some people also planted black locust because it grows fast and it sends out rhizomes. So it self-propagates and it will grow mm-hmm. in these incredibly dry sandy soils. Problem with black locust is it doesn't know where to stop.
It
doesn't stay where you put it because it keeps creeping and creeping and creeping and creeping, just like sumac, for instance.
That sounds like it's going to be hard to get rid of that.
It is, and what you have to do if you're going to control black locust, because it's clonal and it forms these clones of multiple stems and multiple trees, you have to cut down every single one and then treat every stump. If you're using the cut stump treatment, you have to treat every single stump. If you leave a few trees, then it will simply respread by rhizomes from those trees, and it spreads really fast. Another choice is to go and cut down all the trees, let them resprout, and then in the late summer, you can go and then spray those resprouts with a broadleaf herbicide, brush-killing herbicide specifically designed for killing black locusts. And that's actually easier just to cut them down, remove the wood, let them resprout in the first year, so they're about 3-4 feet tall in mid late summer, and then spray them with a broadleaf herbicide, and that will kill the whole clone as well.
And now we have Keita in Phelps. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Keita?
I'm doing well, thanks. I have a question. We have patches of knapweed in a field that we're trying to convert to prairie. So I want to get rid of the knapweed first, and those basil rosettes are still green. Can we spray through the winter, as long as obviously we don't have the snow? And I've got some milestone for that, or do I have to wait until July?
The trick with most herbicides is that the air temperature needs to be 60 degrees Fahrenheit for it to be effective, even if you have green leaves. And, of course, the plant also has to be actively growing. And even though they have green leaves, they may not really be actively growing and may not absorb the herbicide and translocate it. And the chances of you getting 60 degrees in Phelps in the next 4 months is going to be pretty slim. I doubt that the plant will even be active enough to absorb the herbicide and translocate it down into the roots. So I would wait until the appropriate time next year. The problem is those basil rosettes are so much easier to spray than the whole plant with all the leaves extended. Then you run the risk of collateral damage to any desirable plants nearby.
Go ahead, Keita.
Is it still possible to do it early spring before any of the natives start to green up?
Possibly. And when you're using a broadleaf herbicide, most broadleaf herbicides are fairly effective in early spring compared to, say, a glyphosate or Roundup equivalent, which requires that the plants be more actively growing. Spring weeds in early spring with glyphosate is usually very ineffective because the plants are not at the right stage. However, most of your broadleaf herbicides, being more potent and more powerful, are more readily absorbed and translocated early in the spring to do that. Now, for knapweed, I'm not exactly sure what your best choice is. Have you used Milestone on it already?
No, we haven't, but I picked some up not too long ago, and because I heard that that's the best for knapweed was the Milestone.
There you go. So I would wait until the plants are more actively growing, but I bet you could, with Milestone, you should probably be able to get away with it in early to mid-spring. There's anything on the label? I don't think there is anything on the label about knapweed. So I would do some experimentation. Do some in early spring, mid-spring, late spring, and see where you get the best results. Do a statistical analysis, and then please send me the data.
Sure.
Yeah. Good luck, Keita. Thanks very much for the call. Andrea on Facebook says, do you have any suggestions on specific plants or techniques for a ground cover for a 100-foot by 100-foot clearing in a woodland area in south central Wisconsin? It would be driven on occasionally. Wow, that's a... Mm. All right, so specific plants
driven.
Or...
It's going to be driven on with a vehicle?
I guess so.
That does complicate matters.
Yeah, because plants don't like to be driven on.
No, most plants don't like to be... I mean, grasses are the exception, which is why grasses mm-hmm. are commonly used for lawns. I mean, they're just really versatile in so many ways. A ground cover that can be a native ground cover that can be driven on. Boy.
Well, maybe we have to give her a grass, huh?
Yeah, but for...
But if she has a clearing, she might not want a tall grass.
If it's well drained, well, you don't have to... No, if it's well drained, an outstanding choice is Pennsylvania sedge, Carex pennsylvanica. Now, this will not grow on heavy clay. It likes a sandy loam, and surprisingly dry soils. It typically is found in oak savanna situations, and it creeps by rhizomes to form patches. However, it's quite slow growing. So the rate of spread is relatively low, but you can drive on it occasionally, and it's impervious to that as long as you're not driving on it when it's wet or can be damaged by overdriving on it too much. So Pennsylvania sedge, the problem with Pennsylvania sedge is it's only available as plants because the seed production on that species is extraordinarily low and infrequent in any given year. So you only could put it in by putting in transplants. So if you put the plants in 1 foot on center, that would be a fairly expensive proposition for covering a large area. But that would be your best choice. There are many other wonderful ground covers, like the wild ginger, but you can't really drive on the wild ginger. Mayapple, which gets a little bit taller, gets a couple feet tall, that will spread by rhizomes and will take over most other plants, but you can't really drive on that either.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes. Can you talk a little bit about the native grasses? There's some beautiful, there's a beautiful photo on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page of just really attractive in the winter, especially. Some suggestions on native grasses that we might use.
You know, if you look at a prairie, it's a grassland ecosystem. Okay, and it's the fabric of that ecosystem is grass. And if you look at the prairie as a tapestry, the flowers provide the colors, but the weave is the grass. And the flowers bloom spring, summer, fall, but the grasses, depending on the species, will stand up and give you late fall and winter color. And if you look at, you know, when we plant material, plant like trees and shrubs, we have greens and blues of the spruces and pines, but those are cool colors. But the prairie grasses are orange and red and gold. So you have switchgrass, which stands up very well. You have little blue stem, which turns red in the fall. It's absolutely gorgeous. You've got also Indian grass, which stands up fairly well, but if you get ice, that will be knocked down. But those are three of your most colorful grasses that have some size to them that can show up through the snow in the winter.
Yeah, and I suppose I can learn more about them at prairienursery.com.
There's a lot of information there, you bet.
Neil DeBall is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. That's prairienursery.com. There's also a link to that on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens continues to grow, and it's no surprise since they have a lot of qualities to recommend them. I'm Joy Cardine, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and on this edition of Garden Talk, we are talking about native plants and prairie varieties with Neil DeBall, who is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. If you have a question about native plants, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Neil DeBall from Prairie Nursery comes by a few times a year to talk about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. And Neil, as we've been commenting over the news, a lot of people have questions on how to get rid of non-native species that they want to get rid of before they establish their native gardens. And you say this is a good time of year to do some of that.
Depending on what you're trying to get rid of,
particularly
woody plants. Herbaceous plants, it's very difficult because it's not the growing season, and most of the herbaceous plants you're controlling, you're either doing it by tillage or by smothering or by spraying with herbicides. Those sorts of activities don't yield much results if you do them in the winter. So you're better off in the late fall, winter, early spring. So those are more growing season activities, but for controlling invasive woody plants like buckthorn and honeysuckle and black locusts and all these kind of aggressive plants, you can do that very effectively with herbicides, or there are non-herbicide methods as well, and one of those methods is called a weed wrench. where.
Yeah, in fact, we had a brush jack. I'm sorry. Is that the same thing?
I assume that brush jack, Weed Ranch is the name of a product. It's made out in Oregon. I think you can check. Just Google Weed Ranch and it should come up.
Okay, a caller had suggested that. So, yes. what do you do with this weed wrench?
Well, it's this big contraption with these clamps that grasp the stem of a shrub, like a buckthorn. It's best for single-stemmed shrubs. And usually buckthorn is one that qualifies for that, unless it's a multi-stem plant, but usually it's single. And then it has a big lever arm, a handle, that then pulls the plant up by the roots out of the ground. And you can pull some pretty doggone big buckthorn out of the ground because it uses leverage.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this is if you have any desirable plants nearby, because you're ripping it out by the roots, and there's a significant amount of soil and roots that come up when you do this. If you have wildflowers associated with this, you run the risk, or grasses or ferns or whatever. When you rip that buckthorn or other non-desirable shrub out, you're going to pull up a lot of soil and potentially the roots of the desirable plants. So it's for best use in areas where you have no desirable herbaceous vegetation that could be damaged in the process.
Well, you know, there are also those, though, who would like to talk about how they can establish a native garden. Let's see. We have Jeff who emails, I have 4 mature oaks on my urban lot. How do I establish native woodland plants? Is root damage likely to introduce oak wilt?
That's a very good question. And, of course, you always want to be very sensitive to damaging oak roots as well as oak branches, especially when the vector is active, the fungal vector that is active. So you don't want to do any pruning during a summer and a fall. Most of your pruning is done in the winter and early spring on oaks. Now, most oaks have deep roots, tap roots or near tap roots. So the surface soil, you can usually garden under oaks with no issue as long as you're careful. And the most important thing before you begin establishing other plants is to make sure that you eliminate all the non-desirable vegetation so you have a clean slate for installing your plants. Now, most woodland plants are a little more difficult to grow from seed. Not all, but most are a little more difficult to grow from seed, and the seed is commonly expensive. On a small area, most people will use transplants. The nice thing about most of your woodland plants is that they are dividable. Trilliums are a notable exception. Most of the trilliums, the prairie trillium is dividable. Most of the others are a little tricky. But many of your woodland plants, bloodroot and Virginia bluebells and smilacinas, the Solomon seal, false Solomon seal, mayapple, these are all readily dividable as the plants grow. After 3 to 5 years, you get more sets or offshoots that come from them. So you can then expand your garden without paying for more plants, as long as you're willing to do the work of dividing them. So most people will start their woodland wildflower gardens from plants rather than seeds. Also, plants are much easier to track and control weeds around with seeds. They come up slowly. Some seeds, like the lily family, which includes the Solomon seal, false Solomon seal, trilliums, etc., these are double dormant, and they won't come up for 2 years after you seed them. So you're waiting 2 years just for them to germinate, and then they tend to grow very slowly, so it takes 5 to 10 years to get a blooming flower.
Now, why do I want, Neil, a prairie garden or a native garden as opposed to daylilies and non-native plants?
That's a really good question. It depends upon your goals for your landscape. Okay, I like the biodiversity of having a wide variety of different flowers, grasses, ferns, etc. on my property. Now, there's lots of non-native plants with which you can accomplish this too. Part of the reason I do this is just it's a restorative process. It makes me feel good. I want to make sure that I'm doing something good for the earth. But perhaps more importantly are the relationships between native plants and our native insects and other wildlife, particularly pollinators and other beneficial insects like the parasitic wasps. So you have this strong, strong connection between native plants and native insects that is not the case with non-native plants, which have those connections with the plants in the regions in which they originated. But when they're moved outside of their area or outside of their natural habitat here to North America, they're not there to support the insects they once had. And so the native insects can use very few of the native insects can use a lot of your non-native plants. The non-native plants have been shown to really support a much, much broader variety of our native species.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question about native plants for Neil DeBall of Prairie Nursery. 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. Or you can email your question to talk@wpr.org. Carolyn in Madison is with us. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi. For 4 years now, I've been walking past this piece of city land that's had some patches of yarrow in the lawn. And it's been interesting. When I first saw it, I thought, well, it gets mowed every week, so it's bound to die. I couldn't imagine how it could be, how it could survive. And but it was there the next spring, and it was the year of a drought in August. And it was the only green patch left in that stretch of lawn.
Interesting, yeah.
And it was back the next year, and it was back this year.
So it's pretty hardy, apparently.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. And the plants stay short. Well, anyway, I'd like to recommend it as something to add to lawn seed.
Oh, now what is it? Is that a native grass, this yarrow?
It's actually a native flower, Acalaea millifolium. It's actually circumboreal in distribution, meaning that it occurs all around the northern hemisphere, both the east and the west hemispheres in the north. So it grows in Europe, it grows in northern Asia, it grows in North America. So yes, it is native to our area, and it is a member of the Aster family, and it's in a subfamily that is also known for allelopathy, or using chemical warfare to exclude other plants by exuding chemicals into the soil. So it's a quite aggressive plant, not only by that, but also by rhizomes. So it creates these patches. It's extremely drought resistant, which is why you saw it growing even during drought, Carolyn, that it was able to survive that period of dry weather. And it can be quite aggressive in certain situations. But it's a beautiful plant. It has beautiful white flowers. It has wonderful ferny-like foliage. And it is a tough, tough survivor.
Yes.
Now, be warned, I would not put this in my prairie. Even though it's a native plant, I would not put this in my prairie. I was doing a project, helping somebody with a project, and it was like a 7-acre project, and they wanted yarrow in it. The client wanted yarrow. And I said, I would not put any yarrow because it's too aggressive. And the landscape architect insisted on it, and I said, well, just use a very small amount. So they put 1 ounce of yarrow. Now, yarrow has 100,000-plus seeds per ounce. Okay, 1 ounce per acre. Okay, there's 43,560 square feet per acre. So it was about 2 to 3 seeds per square foot. I said, I wouldn't do this. They did it, and in 2 years, it turned into a solid field of yarrow. It's a very aggressive plant, and because it has that ability to use chemical warfare to exclude the growth, or at least retard the growth of other plants, it rapidly gained ascendance over all the other species. So, but it's a wonderful plant, a beautiful plant. It's native, and in the right situation, fantastic. So, yeah, why don't you just get rid of the lawn and plant yarrow?
That's nice to know. I promised that we'd talk a little bit about low-maintenance lawns and caring for low-maintenance lawns. What is a low-maintenance lawn?
Well, there's different types of low-maintenance lawns. There are low-maintenance lawns that are composed of grasses that are naturally require very low nutrient levels, reduced watering, reduced mowing. And we have a product called our No-Mow Lawn. This is going to be the 25th year that we've offered this product coming up here. Oh, excuse me, 22nd year. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. And it is 6 different fine fescues, a blend, and they are adapted to growing in well-drained soils like sandy loams, etc. And they're very good for drier soils. They won't tolerate moisture, and they don't do well on clay. So that's an area where you're not going to have good results. But if you have the right soil, these fescues require little or no fertilizing. Only time you would ever need to irrigate them is during a drought like 2012.
Yeah.
In my house, where I have a lot of this, in the drought of 2012, I never watered it. It was fine. Never skipped a beat. So it's very tough stuff. Other types of low-maintenance lawns are composed of low-growing perennial herbaceous plants. And some people use creeping thyme. There's a wide variety, and I'm not an expert at this area, but there are a wide variety of mostly non-native plants that make a low-maintenance lawn. The yarrow would be a low-maintenance choice, although it will get a little bit taller. And if you have weed ordinances, quote-unquote, that require you to keep your lawn to 6 inches, the yarrow will get taller than that. But there are many low-growing plants, a clover, white clover, sunscreen, which was commonly used as like 5% of your turf mix in the 50s and 60s before we were brainwashed into believing that all of our lawns should look like golf courses.
Right. I remember white clover, yeah.
And the clover added nitrogen to your soil, so you didn't have to fertilize it. Well, we can't make any money on that, so we got to talk people into not having clover in there, and then we'll have to use all our herbicides and all our chemicals and all our fertilizers to have this lawn that looks like a golf course, and we'll put all these toxic substances and all these nutrients that run off into our lakes and streams and destroy the environment by selling you all this junk.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Lori in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. About 5 years ago, I got probably about six plants. They're snake root, and only two exist. One is on its third site because it was struggling in the other sites, and I have sandy soil, and I planted it in an area with some wild ginger. Now, I thought I heard you say that wild ginger secretes a chemical that will kill other plants. Will it bother that? Because I've got, I think, bluebells there and a couple of bleeding hearts, and I really don't want to lose this snake root after babying it for so long, because it finally flowered this year, and it was wonderful.
Okay, I assume that's a black snake root, not a white snake root, right?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Okay.
So black is more hardy than the white? Or
no, Simisifuga is actually not a native to Wisconsin. Oh. So it's a little north of its normal habitat, and sometimes it can be a little touchy. White snake root is a Eupetaurium rugosum, and it's basically a native woodland weed.
Okay.
And you can't kill that stuff. Although, I will say this, it grows all over my property. It does not invade into the wild ginger because the wild ginger keeps it out. I've never had black snake root growing in amongst the wild ginger. So I can't really answer your question.
Will the wild ginger, though, hurt? She's got bluebells and bleeding heart, too.
I don't know because I don't mix other plants with it because
normally
for
it
that
does.
Very concern.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I think you've got an experiment going on here, Lori, that would definitely benefit all of us if you could document that. But if you have an established perennial and the wild ginger is coming in from the sides, I'm going to guess that those established perennials can probably coexist with the wild ginger. I can't guarantee you that, but typically when I'm using it, I'm completely eliminating all existing vegetation and putting in my transplants, and then I have to weed between those in the first year or two to make sure they don't get weeds coming in the wild ginger. Once the wild ginger forms a solid mat, that's when it keeps out other plants. So if it's not already there, I'm going to guess you'll probably be okay, but beware, it is a pretty tough customer, that wild ginger.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori, for the call. Speaking of wild ginger, Mary Jo emails, I live near a maple forest that used to have a huge patch of wild ginger, but the ginger disappeared one year. What might have caused this? It's an email,
okay.
So I'm not sure. But a large patch of wild ginger that apparently just disappeared.
I wish I knew what year it was. In the drought of
2012. Maybe a drought. Yeah.
In drought of 2012, the wild ginger went dormant in July. It just freaked out. Okay, it didn't die, at least not at my house.
Oh,
in places I know.
Okay.
But it just says, hey, I can't grow under these conditions. I'm a perennial. I'm going to go dormant. I'll be back next year. And so the appearance was that it had died by July of 2012. However, the next year, it reappeared and resumed just as it normally was. So now I have a customer who had, this is very interesting, I had a customer over in eastern Wisconsin who told me that he had a beautiful bed of wild ginger on his hillside in his front yard, and it just mysteriously died one year. I myself have never experienced this, so I honestly don't know, but it is not without precedent that something like this has occurred. I'm going to guess that there was either some critter that ate the roots or
yeah,
and when in doubt, blame it on aliens.
I always blame the weather, but that's
know.
Me.
That's a tough plant. So, yeah. It's really hard to understand how an entire patch of wild ginger, which is what happened at my clients, the entire patch died.
Yeah.
Because it was like someone came and sprayed it.
Well, maybe that happened.
That would be really weird. I mean, yeah. Certainly not outside the realm of possibility.
John wants to know, where can he buy Wood Lily, and when, Neil, are you publishing your book? Are you working on a book?
I've been working on a book for 10 years, and it's 98% done, and we were so busy this year, I've had zero time to work on it, and it's that close. It's almost there. But, you know, I got to take care of my customers first.
Yeah. So. What about this Wood Lily?
Wood Lily, Lilium Philadelphicum. It's a fantastic plant. It grows in prairies. It grows in savannas. It's a kind of a touchy plant, kind of specific to its habitat. We don't grow that plant because, first of all, the deer love it. I had a big field of it, and the deer just demolished it because it wasn't protected. So it was really a disaster. It does seem to be fairly specific in where it will grow. You can, however, it is available from a company in Baraboo called Bluestem Farm, and they specialize in unusual plants. So you can contact Bluestem Farm in Baraboo. I don't think they ship plants. You have to go there by appointment. They also have a booth at the farmer's market on the square.
And you do not carry it because it is tricky.
It's tricky, and you know, I don't want to sell you a plant that you don't have a high chance of having good results with. It seems to be fairly specific to its growing conditions, soil, etc. I've tried to grow it at my house with very limited results, and I'm pretty good at growing plants, but this thing has been really, really tough. And if it's not fenced and protected from deer, it's gone.
Okay. Let's go next to Matthew in Sauk County. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question?
Yes, we planted a bunch of black walnut trees about 10 years ago. One side's growing good, but the other side has a bunch of box elders that keep stunting the growth of the black walnut. How can you manage the box elders? Because they just seem to be very invasive on us.
Well, as one of my first bosses told me, Neil, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw.
Okay.
And both box elder and black walnut they're both native trees. Okay, but just because a tree is native doesn't mean that it's all wonderful and warm fuzzy. Box elder is basically a weed from a behavioral standpoint, as you're probably noticing. It seeds readily and invades open areas rapaciously. So if I'm getting rid of box elder, I have a zero tolerance policy at my property for box elder. Anytime I see a box elder, I get rid of it. And we had box elder bugs up the wazoo when we first moved there. I cut down all the box elders, and away went the box elder bugs. So
they only like the box elder tree for the most part.
They love the box. I won't say it's exclusive to that, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Once I got rid of the box elders, we had almost no box elder bugs.
But a chainsaw is what you use.
Chainsaw. Cut it down in the fall or the winter, and then treat the cambium with a broadleaf herbicide or 40% glyphosate just inside the bark all the way around the stump immediately after cutting. You can't let it callus over or dry out. So immediately after you cut the tree down, and this only works September, October, November, December, January, February, into March. Cut the tree down and immediately drip, 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 drip the herbicide, concentrated herbicide all the way just inside the bark, and that will translocate down in the roots and it will kill your box elder. If you don't do that and you just cut it down, it's going to resprout and you'll have 6 foot tall box elders in 1 year with now you've got 20 new sprouts instead of the one trunk. So that's really the way to get rid of that stuff.
Julia in Mequon is with us. Hi, Julia.
Hello. Yes, I would like to know how to get rid of Creeping Charlie that is creeping all over the yard here without damaging the deciduous and evergreen trees that we have.
Okay, without damaging the what?
Evergreen trees and what else, Julia?
Deciduous trees, like maples and apple trees.
Okay. Well, Creeping Charlie is extremely difficult to control because Creeping Charlie is a ground-hugging species, and you can mow it and mow it and mow it. Mowing actually favors it because by removing the competition above it, it opens it up to light. So if you have Creeping Charlie in your lawn and you mow it, it's just going to make it worse. And it creeps by rhizomes, and you can pull it out, and you think you've got it all out, and it just miraculously reappears. It's almost impossible to kill.
You know, I never had Creeping Charlie until I heard Larry Mueller talking about how he tried to get rid of his Creeping Charlie. It's really hard to get rid of, isn't it?
It's extremely hard to get rid of. And there's really no organic solution to it other than pulling it out or smothering the area, but then you have the weed seeds of the Creeping Charlie dormant in the soil, and then you reseed your lawn, and it comes right back. Unfortunately, most people do resort to a broadleaf herbicide to kill it, and as long as you use a broadleaf herbicide that is labeled for use on a lawn situation under trees, there are a few broadleaf herbicides that can translocate down into the soil, get into the tree roots, and kill the trees. Dicamba is particularly notorious for this. So if the herbicide has dicamba in it, you usually want to have like less than 3% of that, assuming that you're willing to use herbicides to kill it. But it's a really tough customer. And what I do at my house is I have a no-mow lawn, which is our no-mow lawn product of fine fescues. And wherever I let that grow unmowed, I have no dandelions. I have no Creeping Charlie.
Neat.
I have none of the weeds that you typically find in the lawn because the grasses grow so tall that they smother those ground-hugging weeds.
Well, I'm going to have to look into that no-mow lawn, that's for sure. You know, we have just a minute to go. Neil, is there anything else we should keep in mind as we get closer to winter?
Well, really important to plan your landscaping. Winter is a fantastic opportunity to look at your property and prioritize your projects and make sure that you look at all the different steps necessary to be successful with your native plantings, whether you're putting in a garden, whether you're putting in a prairie from seed. Make sure that you have a step-by-step plan that is, you can implement, and make sure you block out the time at the time of the year, whether you're killing weeds, whether you're smothering. If you're going to kill weeds by smothering, you want to put that black plastic or cardboard or whatever you're using, put that down early in the spring so you get as long a smothering time as possible, and keep it down all the way until the fall. Then you can go in and plant in the fall. If you're spraying weeds, then you want to make sure you have your timing figured out. Get your whole plan together, and then you'll be set for the year.
Thank you so much. We'll talk again. Neil DeBall is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.